Jeremiah's life is one of those cases. And so I want to begin there. I'm going to, as you see, the title of the sermon this morning, Lessons in Reality, the Object Lessons in Real Life. And so I want to go through a number of them, and I don't think that I'm hitting all of them. I think there's quite a few that are actually still missing. And they will also not be in order the way that they are written. And I hope that that is not going to be a hindrance for you in getting this message. Anyway, the first one that I want to touch in on is Jeremiah chapter 16, verses 1 through 9. Jeremiah, where do I got to aim this? There we go. Jeremiah is told not to get married. No marriage for you, my friend. And no children for you, my friend, either. So this privilege that our parents had up here this morning, Jeremiah was not able to have that. Who is this message for? This message was written for the entire nation of Judah. Actually, it was written for Israel. But Judah had split away from the whole of Israel, the larger portion of the nation. But they hadn't kept that name. They had taken the name Judah. The larger portion had kept the original name. And so throughout the book, as you read it, both groups are mentioned. It's almost like God has forgotten that this people are not one people anymore. Even though the message was primarily for the whole of the nation, it's not just for the whole of the nation, it is also for us as individuals, and it's also for other nations as well. At first glance, this would seem to be a hardship for Jeremiah. Marriage and children were a blessing. It was a privilege, a status symbol in Jeremiah's time. So he's instructed not to have either. You can't have children, can't be married. So what am I? Who am I? I'm defined by my marriage. I'm defined by my children. And so what God is trying to communicate here is that he has cut himself off from the people. We have talked about this in this series before, and I'm going to say it again. It may not have been that God cut himself off, but it may have been that God finally just gave the people what they were asking for through their actions. And so my advice to all of us is that we don't cut God out of our life. Sometimes it's tempting to cut him out. He's interfering too much in my life. He's causing me to have difficulties. But don't cut him out of your life, because he may just give you what you want. So as I was working over this, I remembered an old hymn. It says, "Don't overlook salvation while living here in sin. Someday it may be too late to pray. Someday when you need him, he may not let you in. How awful if he should turn you away." Kind of seems like the message that's being communicated to the nation of Israel, whether they got it or not, that's not the point. But Jeremiah's life of celibacy and singleness is communication that God has turned away. God has removed himself. God is treating this people as though they are not his children. Judah as though she is not his bride. But then it doesn't just stay there. Jeremiah is further instructed not to go to the places of mourning. He's told not to mourn at all. And he's also instructed not to go to the places of celebration. He's not supposed to celebrate at all. Jeremiah is supposed to become numb. Do you ever feel numb? Your emotions are just numb. Well, this is what Jeremiah is called to become, numb. We rely so much on our emotions to guide us. This is how I feel. This is maybe the place where this restriction might have been a merciful thing from God's viewpoint. If Jeremiah had been married, if Jeremiah had had children, to communicate these messages would have just been so much harder than where he was now. Jeremiah's life is an object lesson of how God's compassion is gone. God says, I'm not going to celebrate with you. I'm not going to celebrate you. I'm not going to mourn with you. I'm not going to mourn for you. I'm removing myself. Have it your way. And so Pastor Rempel talked about the discouraged prophet last week. And this is kind of where God is feeling. He's kind of like this discouraged prophet. He's removed. He's discouraged. It's how God feels concerning the people of Israel. So I want to place this as a bookend to the object lessons that are in the book of Jeremiah. God has removed himself from us. But God hasn't completely removed himself. God is still with Jeremiah. He's still the prophet. And God is still there. And during this time, you also have other prophets that are there. When you read through the Bible and you these other prophets, they were in the same time frame as what Jeremiah was. And you have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who were actually exiled to Babylon. And when we read their story, they weren't separated from God either. And so God has separated himself from the people as a whole, but not necessarily from the individuals. That's where the message to the nation comes in. The next object lesson that I want to draw your attention to is likely the most popular of the object lessons in Jeremiah. It's the potter and the clay, and it can be found in chapter 18, verses 1 through 12. I'm going to read very little of this scripture this morning. I'm hoping that you will go home and that you will read it so that you can check whether or not these things that I'm saying are actually truth. God tells Jeremiah to go down to the potter's house and there he will give him a message. It's quite easy when we read these illustrations that we find more in these illustrations than what God is actually trying to communicate. And I think this is one of the reasons why we like this one, is because there's actually an explanation that goes on. When Jeremiah goes down to the potter's house, he's going to see a lot of things that are going on. Outside at the potter's house is someone who is likely working with clay. They are prepping the clay for the purpose of making it into pottery. Inside will be different people working on different things, but there's a wheel, and they're getting that process ready. But there's also another process. He's taking it away, and then it sits, and then it dries for a bit. And then it's baked, and then there's someone who's going to paint it. And so all these processes, all these things are things that Jeremiah would have seen when he went down to the potter's house. But God says, only focuses on what's happening on the wheel. The potter works the clay. He fashions it into a vessel that he chooses. If he doesn't like what he sees, he destroys it and starts over until he is pleased with the product. And so during my study, I took advantage of the internet because I'm not a potter. I did do a little bit of it in industrial arts when I was in school, and I don't really care for it. It's sticky on my hands. And I wasn't very good at it either. And so I watched some of these people, and so they're working this clay, but they're actually working this clay for the purpose of destroying it. Well, if the potter chooses to work a piece of clay for the purpose of destroying it, he has that option. And so Jeremiah might have seen that at the wheel. In verse 11, we read what the Lord says, "Look, I am preparing a disaster for you and devising a plan against you." Part of the message. It sounds like God is planning destruction, and he can do that if he chooses. In most cases, the clay has no say whatsoever in what happens to it. And yet sometimes it seems that clay has a mind of its own. The potter gets to be as picky as he chooses to be. So when paralleled with Israel, or us as individuals, we have a choice of complying or not. Someplace in here it said, should the clay say to the potter, and then instruct the potter as to how it should be made? It sounds ludicrous. And yet, it's communicated that the clay has a choice in this process, to be whether it wants to be submissive or whether it wants to be stubborn. And so humor me for a little bit. So the potter sits down at the wheel, takes his little ball of clay and slaps it down on the wheel and starts working on it. He's determined that it's going to be practice. This first one's going to be practice. And so this doesn't really fit with our picture of God, because God doesn't need to practice. God gets it right the first time. It's our way of doing things. And God chooses to use our way of doing things as an example for us as to how it fits in with his picture. And so he grabs this first piece of clay. It's going to be practice. And he starts working it. And all of a sudden, this clay just moves really well. And he actually likes what's happening to this piece of clay. And so at the beginning, he had determined that he was going to destroy it. It was just going to be practice. He was going to work it so long until it was junk. Then he was going to scrape it off that wheel and start fresh. And start with a real one. But instead he chooses to keep the first piece because it works really well. And so he scrapes it off, puts it over and lets it dry. Grabs another block. But that clay somehow has got some other elements in it and maybe not have been prepped properly or whatever that case may be. But it doesn't want to form in his hands. And no matter how hard he tries, this clay just doesn't seem to want to cooperate with him. That's what I say when the clay has it. Well, that second piece was supposed to become that instrument or that vessel that he was going to market. But instead, he destroys it and starts over again. A little bit of a picture of, I think, how God works and our role in that and what it looks like when we are submissive or stubborn. There's the wrecked piece. Scrape it off, get rid of it, start new. So here's what we learn. God is sovereign. And submit to God. Two things that I think are overlying things. You could pull a whole lot of other things out of this one. So let's say God has spent his time at the potter's wheel. And he has made a vessel that he actually likes. This is getting into the next illustration that I want to go into. You can find that in chapter 19, verses 1 through 15. Here Jeremiah is instructed to go and buy a pot, one that is already complete. So he buys maybe something like this. Then he calls people together. He calls together the leaders, the elders of the people, and some of the leading priests of the temple. He calls these together, and he says, "Let's go for a walk." And so, he goes for a walk to a place called Ben Hinnom. Now, what is Ben Hinnom? The valley of Ben Hinnom would be like our lagoon, only a little bit worse. On a nice summer day, if you're standing in the right place, the lagoon can give off an odor that is a fresh country-like smell. Ben Hinnom is a little bit different. It's a picture of what we would used to have called our dump and the lagoon all together, all mixed together into one. So a picture of this. And so Jeremiah calls these people out, takes them over there. He's carrying his jar. So Jeremiah brings in another aspect that I can't bring in over here, and that is the smell and the sights of this particular environment. And here Jeremiah is supposed to deliver a message. So that's part of the example, part of the object lesson is the smell. So this, here he says this. Michelle, if you want to pull up that scripture, it says this. Listen, I am going to bring a disaster on this place that will make the ears of everyone who hears it tingle. For they have forsaken me and made this a place of foreign gods. They have burned incense in it to gods that neither they nor their ancestors nor their kings of Judah ever knew. They have filled this place with the blood of the innocent. They have built the high places of Baal to burn their children in the fire as offerings to Baal, something I did not command or mention, nor did it ever enter my mind. So beware, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when people will no longer call this place Topheth or the Valley of Ben-Hinnom, but the Valley of Slaughter. And so if you think it's garbage now, it's going to become a lot worse. In this place, I will ruin the plans of Judah and Jerusalem. I will make them fall by the sword before their enemies at the hands of those who want to kill them. I will give their carcasses as food to the birds and the wild animals. I will devastate this city and make it an object of horror and scorn. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff because of all its wounds. I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and daughters, and they will eat one another's flesh because the enemies will press the siege so hard against them to destroy them. The walls of their city of Jerusalem that were supposed to be protection were going to become exactly the opposite. Now I wouldn't let them out. This is a disturbing message. If their stomachs weren't turning because of the smells and the sights of this place, it should have turned because of the words. Then Jeremiah is told to smash this jar along with these words. This is what the Lord the Almighty says. I will smash this nation and this city just as this potter's jar is smashed and cannot be repaired. They will bury the dead in Topheth and until there is no more room. This is what I will do to this place and to those who live here, declares the Lord. I will make this city like Topheth. The houses in Jerusalem and those of the kings of Judah will be defiled like this place. Topheth, all the houses where they burned incense on the roofs to all the starry hosts and poured out drink offerings to other gods. This jar is to be smashed. You want to go to that next slide of mine there, Michelle? There we go. Now, unlike the potter at the potter's wheel, try to put this thing back together. That jar wasn't smashed. You know, sometimes we have a piece of china that falls down on the floor, and it's really valuable to us, but it's only broken into three pieces, and so we go over to the hardware store and we buy some of this really good glue, and we glue it together, and it's still functional somewhat. When you smash something like this, it's not going to be put back together. Well, who's this message for? It's for the city of Jerusalem and its people. But Jerusalem is God's city. God's going to smash Jerusalem. God's going to tear Jerusalem apart. Makes no sense. But the message here is pretty clear. There's very little room for interpretation. God will destroy whatever, even the things that are of value, if it doesn't serve his intentions. And God does not always rebuild. The city of Jerusalem gave the people a false hope. And so that which was created to be a blessing to the people had become their downfall. Their security wasn't their city. Their security wasn't their people. No longer in God. By God removing it, the people were actually better off, even though they would mourn the loss. This message didn't sit well with the chief priest or the temple chief officer. And so he had Jeremiah beaten, put in the court, in a variety of different places, an empty cistern and stocks, just to name a few. And so this is followed by another object lesson. Jeremiah's got another one in his back pocket, and he says, oh, here's what is going to happen then to Pashur. Chapter 20, verses 1 through 6. Your name is going to be changed. And this is an object lesson to the leaders of the temple. It's a little bit more personal. All the rest of them had been for the community as a whole, for the nation, or for the city, or for... This is hitting close to home. This message was to a specific high priest, and yet it was a message to the religious order. In Bible times, names had a lot more significance than what they do today. We debate about the names of our children, but we don't quite give them the meaning that they did in Bible times. And so we're not quite sure what the meaning of Pashur was. That's not quite spelled out, but we do know what the meaning of the name was that it was changed to. Magor Missabib, something like that. And so what is that meaning? It means terror on every side. How would you like to be called terror? If you are supposed to be a place of refuge or a person of refuge. He was going to be terror on every side, to himself, to his friends, and to his countrymen. The place or organization that was supposed to be a place of refuge